Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Please excuse my voice for this introduction, as at the time of recording, I was recovering from the flu. South African actor, performer, and artist Craig Obani has been in the industry for a couple of decades. His theatre credits include The Buddy Holly Story, Grease, Fame, Thoroughly Modern Millie, Chicago, Contact, Kiss Me Kate, Sound of Music, West Side Story, Rock of Ages, and many more. Craig's television credits include Shadows, Isidingo, Binnelanders, The Wild, Ashes to Ashes, Scandal, Warriors Season 1, and again many more. Craig's film credits include Woman of Desire, Blitz Petroli, Triggered, Looking for Love, The Contract, and Last Days of American Crime. Craig has appeared on two Royal Variety performance shows. He hosted Miss South Africa in 2007. He was part of Starlight Classics production and a radio presenter on Mix 93.8. His award nominations include Naledi Award nominations for Annie, Chicago, Peter Pan, Morecambe, Fleur de Cup nominations for Chicago and Rocky Horror, and a Laurence Olivier nomination for Contact. He has won a Naledi Award for Rock of Ages, and a Green Room Award for The Buddy Holly Story. Up next on Celeb Savant, live in studio at Solid Gold Podcast in Randburg, Johannesburg, South Africa, we've got Craig Obani.
So, Craig, how are you doing today?
I'm well. It's good to be here, and I'm excited to be talking about what's coming up and to be a part of your podcast. I know a little bit about it, and it's good stuff.
Thank you. Okay, so now let's rewind. At what age did you, whether it was a child or teenager, was that spark or creative thing in your brain saying, okay, this is the route I want to take, and how did that journey flow?
Okay, yeah, there was no question that from a very young age, it came down from my dad's side. He was in a band, and I used to go whenever I could to all the gigs, and when he would let me, I would get up on the drum kit and play drums, and I just could. I could just play and keep in time and do fills and intricate stuff. So the bug bit me very early, and then the teachers in my primary school cottoned onto the fact that Craig sings a bit, and he's not shy to get up and do it. So let's show the other boys that it's okay to do this. It's not something that's mamby pamby, and they pushed me, and then so it started from a very young age. Every Friday afternoon, I would sing a song for our class before they left for the weekend, from Grease or The Idolmaker or something. This is back when I was in primary school, which was the 80s, early 80s. And that would be our send off to the weekend. Was okay, Craig, what are you singing for us today? You know, so it kind of happened early, and I always knew I was going to be a performer in some capacity. I just didn't know what.
So you finished school, and did that direction of what journey in the performance area happen then, or how did that concretize?
So when I was in my final years at school, we used to compete in sort of provincial, I suppose, festivals. And we did some Greek tragedy, and I was playing Telthebius in this Greek play, and I wasn't really committed to it, and I wasn't really focused on it. And I remember the adjudicator making me stand up, and I thought, oh, here we go, I've done something wrong again. And she applauded me and said, everybody, that performance was touching and layered and depth. And I was like, okay, wow, I love this. If I can do well in this without trying, if I really try and actually apply myself, maybe I can make a career out of this, because I certainly had an interest and a desire to do it. My mother had taken me to Eckhard Rabi's house when I was in my final year of school to try and talk me out of it, because Eckhard was teaching then. This is pre-Isidingo, when he had his comeback. And he said, he sort of gave me the you know, the dark side of the industry, but he also encouraged me as well. So he didn't want to just crush my dream. Mm-hmm. So when we left, my mom said to me, I was 17, she said, so what are you going to do? You're leaving school soon. I said, I'm still going to do it. I went to Rhodes. I studied drama and journalism, actually, which was another passion, which is another passion of mine. And then I kind of went where the work was. It hasn't all gone to plan. It's not like I had a big plan of what I wanted to do. Oh, I'm only a straight actor. I don't do musicals, or I only do musicals, not theater, or I only want to do TV. Yeah. I kind of went where the work was, and luckily for me, and thankfully, there was some work for me. And I've had some lean periods, but in my 34 years of being in this industry, not too many. So I've been very very lucky there, and I'm very grateful to be able to say that.
So because you were going with the flow and allowing it just to lead you where it was going, do you feel that maybe that allowed you to have the opportunities that you've had compared to thinking, okay, I'm only doing this, I'm only doing that, because people who do that don't see the other opportunities that are coming into their view?
You know, I get asked often, Craig, what advice would you give young performers? And I'm always stuck between that, exactly that thing you're asking now. Because I've always said, have as many strings to your bow as you can, because it makes you more employable. It makes you, you know, the chances of you making money and making a living are increased. Because let's say, Craig, can you do voiceovers, Craig? Yes. So I go do a voiceover. Craig, will you come in and do a bit of a play reading? Yes, sure. Craig, can you sing? Yes. Do you play an instrument? Yes. So I would always say to youngsters, have as many strings to your bow. Now, the flip side of that is that maybe you become a jack of all and a master of none.
Yeah.
So some youngsters, and I know a lot of very successful young actors in this country that say, I stopped theater to make myself available for TV and film.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have had difficult times because they were going, no, I can't do it. Because what happens is you get a casting that comes in. If you're in a play or in a show, you can't do it. And I've had this happen to me. I got cast in an international film while I was doing The Sound of Music at the end of last year. I couldn't do it because it clashed. So it's that double-edged sword, because you're kind of thinking, well, I work because Craig, do you MC? Sure.
Yeah.
Craig, do you do voiceover? Sure. Craig, can you sing? Sure. Can you act? Can you do this? Can you do that? But a lot of the youngsters, and I respect them for it, say, I'm going to specialize. I'm going to focus on my TV and film career. That's what I'm doing, even if it means I sit for periods out of work. So I don't know.
Let's dive into being in front of the camera. What do you enjoy about that?
It's such a different – because my home – is theater. I mean, that's what I've done the most of. That is when I'm doing theater, I feel like I'm doing what I was born to do or destined to do in its purest form. So the energy of theater is so different to the energy of filming and being in front of the camera. It's a long waiting game. It's very much a in your own head focus. It's not about feeling the energy of the rest of the cast or you know, everyone doing a warm up together. And revving yourself up necessarily. For me, often they say, Craig, so Craig, less is more on camera. So for me, it's more of a bringing it in, focusing. And so it's a very different process for me. What I do enjoy, and I still feel like I'm really learning in this area. Not that I'm not learning in theater, always learning, but I feel like a fish out of water still a little bit when it comes to screen acting. So when I've had any kind of success in it, I'm the most surprised person in the room. But I do enjoy when I manage to achieve when I watch myself on the camera and if I believe myself and I have achieved some degree of authenticity and believability and stillness and still manage to have some kind of magnetism or charisma. Mm-hmm. I go, okay, great, Craig, you did something right there. I hope I remember what I did. Because less is certainly more. And just trusting that you've got to do so much less and the message will come over on camera, as opposed to having to hit the back wall in the theater, which is what we have to do. And also, you know, lift up, there's the balcony. It's such a different process, and I enjoy the live performance and the TV and film performance on such different levels. It's hard to compare them. They tick different boxes for me, but very fulfilling both.
Okay, so you mentioned watching yourself and knowing that you achieve certain things, the stillness, magnetism, et cetera, et cetera. Now, how do you take out that negative parrot ego brain that every person has, that bah, 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 what I, the monkey on the brain.
Yeah.
When you're watching yourself and step outside of that and know that it's you're looking from this angle, how do you separate that?
Not with any degree of ease. It's quite ironic that performers and actors are seen to be such, and I'm sure we are quite ego driven people, and you know there's a vanity and a self awareness which perhaps other people may not have or may not put on display as much as we do, but actors and the ones that I know and certainly myself, we are the most self deprecating people on the planet, and you're so right. I inevitably watch myself and go, oh, first thing is, oh, I look terrible, or I'm looking old, oh, yeah. I need to lose weight, oh, that was bad. And my mom always says to me, I don't want to watch anything you're in with you because you're going to just tear yourself to pieces.
Yes.
So it's difficult. And that's why when I do watch myself and go, oh, that was okay. I didn't hate that.
Yeah.
That's when I believe, I've done something, I'm maybe achieving something cool. And also when you can see the performance and you're actually not looking at yourself and your flaws and blah, blah, when you just get something from the performance and almost forget you're looking at yourself, that's when I think you're really starting to act well. My fiance is a great Afrikaans actress and she's so good that with the stuff I watch her in, I do forget that I'm watching my fiance.
Yeah.
Because she's that good an actress. But it's very difficult. And I always say I wish the highs were as high as the lows are low in this industry. Because when I do get a part or when I do get a role on stage, I'm happy. But I'm not as happy as I am unhappy when I don't get one, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So, you know, when you do get it, I go, oh, I got the role. I got lucky. It's wonderful. You know, the pendulum swung my way. When I don't, it's, oh, I'm useless. Oh, I need to change my profession. Oh, I've lost it. You know, it's, and we just self-flagellate and beat ourselves up. Yeah.
I laugh because in my world, I do things exactly the same. Like, anyway.
Yeah.
So this is just an observation and perception of me, of mine, of the of the world. So I believe, like, most people, well, I'm talking Western society, and observations of what happens. You know, as kids, we run around naked. What do the parents say? Put clothes on. It's dirty. It's ugly. You have to cover yourself up. So we are already from that age taught, okay, well, we're not beautiful as we are.
Right.
We need to change. We need to cover up. We're not accepted as we are. So that brings in this thing as an adult. Well, when that person looks at themselves in a photograph on the TV in the mirror, they automatically go to the negative parts of, well, okay, this needs to change, that needs to change, this, that, and the other.
Yes.
So this is just an observation of me and the world. So
yeah. No, absolutely. Someone asked me recently. We were on a movie set, and we were playing games. I think it started out as a game where they were pulling cards out of the box, but then eventually everyone just started to ask questions of the other cast members, and they said to me, "What is the one thing that you like so much about yourself, Craig? The one thing you love about yourself that you would never change?" I couldn't answer the question.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't answer the question. I could go the other way.
Yeah.
For days.
Oh yes.
And I couldn't. And they said, "We'll come back to you, Craig." And they went around and asked other people, and they came back, and I said, "I still, because I mean, I could say the obvious things. I believe I'm a kind human, and I believe sometimes I'm encouraging to people. But I was trying to find something, that one thing that you love about yourself that you wouldn't.
That's also not about everyone else.
Yeah, that, exactly. That I wouldn't change this aspect of Craig or Barney, and I battled and failed to find an answer.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, I hear you.
So you've done movies. You've been a long-running stint in Isi Dingo. You're on Legacy.
Mm.
For you, what is the difference between being in a movie, having a shorter stint sort of on Legacy, or compared to a longer stint on Isi Dingo, or doing a one-episode show? Obviously, you approach it the same, but what are the differences for you in those different areas?
You kind of discover it as you're going. If you're doing a short stint thing, then that's all you've got. I did one the other day. I had one day where I had to go in and play a crooked boss in a movie for Di Prente Productions here, and so you have just that day, and you try and feel like you are part of the project. It's difficult because you feel like a visitor.
Yeah.
You feel like a guest. as opposed to when you're in something long running, you're there and then the guests come in. And yeah, so you're on the other side.
Yeah.
Kind of you. So there's a degree of comfort because you know the terrain. You know, I've been here for months and months and, and you try and make the other person who's coming in for a short story arc or a couple of days or one day, you try and make them comfortable and you try and do your thing. That happened to me on Binnenlanders when I arrived. I just had a short arc and then another arc, another arc, another arc. And then of course, you start getting a degree of, you know, comfort and familiarity. I enjoy the longer runs. Obviously, from a work perspective, and you know what you're getting every month, and you know from that aspect. But you know what? Again, what my fiance said off. She was playing the same role in a soapy for 8.5 years, and she left, and she said, "It's not because I don't love it. It's not because I'm ungrateful. But as actors, we don't want to play one character. Mm. We want to do different things." That's when we are kind of doing what we were destined to do in its best form, in its purest form. I want to play different things. I want to be different characters and explore different different acting fabric of Craig O'Barney. But it's always that you know that you're always juggling the security of having a job and knowing what you're getting, and then throwing caution to the wind and saying, "Well, let's see what comes." And again, this comes down to what I was saying to you about people go, "I'm turning things away so that I can focus on, so I can get the roles I want to do." It's a privilege to be in a position to do that. I guess it depends very much on your financial situation, what kind of obligations you have, what kind of responsibilities you have financially, and then some. But for me, I like not being locked into one thing for too long. So I'd rather have a stint and go.
Yeah.
So again, not always by plan. It's happened like that for me. I mean, the longest I've been in, I think what you mentioned, is it because I ended up, it wasn't the plan, but I ended up being there for kind of 5-6 years. Scandal, I was on and off for 4. And then Ashes to Ashes I did, which was a 2-year stint, which I loved. But I would rather do 6 months, maybe a year, and then go do something else, pop a bit of theater in, do a corporate. That's me living my best life.
So this is a little bit controversial. So there's this latest thing that's coming out that the audience projecting on, that a straight person can't play a gay character, that the gay shouldn't play straight, that Jewish shouldn't play this. And this is a bit of controversial, like when Bradley Cooper got Leonard Bernstein, should it be in a Jewish person? What are you, being an actor, you're there to play different characters, different roles, and that's the point of being an actor.
Yes.
With this new thing that's coming out, what are your thoughts around it?
I find that so odd that that's coming out now when everything seems to be going the other way, where there are no rules anymore. Anyone can be anything in life. You don't have to, you don't have to say, I am this, I'm straight, I'm gay, I'm male, I'm female, I'm... You can just be. So it's so odd that in the industry where I would imagine this would be the driving force and in the front seat of the plane pushing this forward, that there is this thing of, oh no, a non-Jewish person can't play a Jewish person in a movie. I disagree with that, because it's acting. So we're here to pretend, and we're here to play a part. And if the actor or actress or whatever does it convincingly, plays tribute to the let's use that as an example, but plays tribute to the man, to the legend, to the maestro, and tells the story, and it moves people and touches people, entertains people, job done. I also think that there is a school, there is a point of view that can be argued that roles shouldn't be taken. Why should he have that role and shouldn't be given to someone from, you know,
the community? Whatever.
Well,
there's conversations for both.
And I agree. But I think it's each case should be looked at on its merit. I don't think you can make that a general sweeping rule for Hollywood or for movies or for the industry, theater industry. I think actors are here to pretend to be something that they're not. And if that serves the piece, serves the whatever the story is, whatever the director and writer are trying to achieve by creating the piece of art, job done, I think.
It's interesting. I'm not mentioning names for obvious reasons. I was at the opening of a theater show a few weeks back, and it was a one-woman show about someone who had breast cancer. Mm. She was portraying the character. And 30 to 40 minutes before the show ended, a woman got up in the audience and started screaming at her, saying, "How the hell do you know you've never had cancer?" And they actually had to escort her out of the production. I was like,
wow.
It was really very intense and very hectic. And
but you see, it's not necessarily a negative thing. I mean, obviously, it wasn't. It interrupted the performance, and yeah, wasn't first prize for the actor for the actress,
yeah,
that night. But the piece is hitting home.
Yeah,
it's working. There were probably a lot of people who may have been feeling the way she was. She just decided she was going to do what I don't consider to be the right thing, and and interrupt a performance. I think it's a bit selfish. She could have waited till afterwards and had her say. But for me, that's almost a kind of it's a compliment. She was telling a very sensitive story, and I think a lot of people are going to be emotional. You know, depending on what experience you've had with the dreadful cancer, and I mean it's. I think people get moved and touched in different ways, and
or triggered
in this case, but that means it's working.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Great segue. Let's dive. You've already mentioned you love the theater because it's your home, first place. What else do you enjoy about it?
I love the immediacy of it. What I love and hate about it is you can have the same role, the same show. You go out on a Wednesday night, you do it, and everything falls into place. You even arrived at the theater thinking, oh, I'm not 100% tonight. I hope it goes well tonight. And then you're out there. It's happening. It's a live thing. It's a live exchange between you and an audience. It's only going to happen like this one time in your life. This is all you got, is this one evening.
Yeah.
And you feel that little bubble of comfort come around you. And you're like, tonight, we've got this.
Mm.
Nothing can go wrong here. And you kind of lean back into it. And you cushion back on it. And it feels amazing. And at the end, you come out and you feel it is the most fulfilling feeling for me as a performer. Then you come on the Thursday night. You are on the high from the night before. You're feeling great. That little bit of a cold you had seems to have really gone. So now you're even in better shape. And nothing that night that you do is going to enable you to find the magic you had the night before. You are trying. You are focused. You are working.
Mm.
And I love and hate that about theater. It's the magic of the immediacy of the one exchange that happens, the live exchange that happens that one night. Some nights it just sits and happens. Some nights it doesn't matter what you do. It's just going to be an okay show.
But wait. Okay, stop there. For the audience, they don't know that the magic's not there.
Yeah, hopefully.
So, I'm sure they don't. How do you know if they do know, first of all?
Well, we hope they don't know.
Okay.
But it's like when I was in London and I was performing and I came off the stage and I had the best show I'd had in ages. I was like, oh, that was vibing. And the resident director was in. And he came around the corner and he said, hi. And I was like, oh, I didn't know you were in. Fantastic. How are you? And he said, are you okay?
Okay.
Is everything? And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, well, you seemed a little off tonight. And so I was like, okay, I don't understand this industry. This confuses the hell out of me. Then I've had nights where you come off feeling like, and they go, wow, you were just firing. You were feeling it tonight. So it's a strange one. Now, we hope that the audience are none the wiser. I always say to performers when young performers come in and say, oh, my voice, all this. I say, guys, you know what? The difference between your best and your worst performance is vast. The difference to an audience is this.
Exactly.
Is this it.
Exactly.
And that's where you got to trust the discipline, trust the craft, trust the fact that you got the job because you're equipped to play the role. So that's where you got to go, okay, look, I've got this. I'm not – but very often when you're feeling a little off your game, you have a better performance because you are drawing on what you can.
Yeah.
Like I often find that I sing better when my voice is slightly tired. As opposed to when I've had 3 weeks off and you come in, you're like, wow, it just feels free and the lid is off.
Yeah,
and you're a little bit, you know. So it's a strange animal. But we do hope that the audience sit there and go, that show, I saw the show last week, saw it tonight, fantastic.
Yeah. Okay, so now
it's not about you. It's not about the actor.
Yeah, exactly. So now how do you, and I'm sure it's a process of over time, those times when the magic's not there, you're feeling it, felt it hasn't gone well. How do you throw that out to be there for the next day? Or is it still there nagging in your brain, like that parrot and monkey we were talking about?
Absolutely. Comes with experience, I think. When I was a younger performer, I mean, my mood, how I treated the people around me, how I felt within myself, it was dictated by that show that night, you know. And I think the older you get, you realize, you know what, you can only control what you can control. And did you try your best? Did you do the job? Then leave it. And don't carry that into tomorrow's show. Easier said than done. But, you know, I mean, I've had roles where, for instance, the Buddy Holly show, I did a lot of times. This is what launched me in 1994. Took me to the UK and then around the world. I performed this role. And doing something for such a long time, I would cruise through months. Just just going.
Mm.
And then suddenly I would hit a hiccup, like stutter on a word or something. And then for the next 3 weeks, that's all you're thinking about. So your performance has been taken from you by some little thing.
And then it's a perceptual thing of you in your brain and your mind.
And so you're so focused on that other things start to suffer.
Yeah.
So I would cruise through months, then claw through weeks, then cruise through another month, then claw through maybe. And it was such an interesting journey because that's the thing I did live the longest. And I think a lot of actors, and I think they're right, you shouldn't do something the same for so long. Different schools of thought on this because some people I know in the UK, you get into a show, you stay in that show. And you're grateful for that. You're working and you're on a West End, you're in a West End show. You're on the West End. Why would you want to go somewhere else? So when you audition for other things, you don't get it. But they say, well, do you want to sign for another year on Starlight Express?
Or yes.
I know people that were there for 11 years, you know, skating for 11 years. it's just come back recently, actually. I love it. I quite like that.
Okay. Now you've referenced this. So now the audience goes to one show. They're there Wednesday night or Saturday night or Friday, whatever. Yeah. You guys often do 6, 7, 8 shows a week.
Mm.
How do you maintain energy, balance, mental health for that period of time doing such intensity?
Discipline. I mean, you know, I think there's always the perception of that what we do is easy in a way. Oh, please, you go in there, you work for a couple of hours a night.
Exactly. It's not easy.
Yeah, and it's really not. And it draws on your person, on your soul, and on your energy, and your battery, in different ways to other jobs. I mean, I haven't done many other jobs, so I can't comment. But I know that this can be a very energy sapping experience if you're for instance, in a kind of a lull. You can't bring your personal problems into this office. You know, if you're working in IT or something and you're having a bad day at home, you can perhaps be a little more in your own world that day. You're not going to socialize at tea break or you know, go for lunch with the guys today. I'm not in the mood. I can't arrive at the theater and go, I'm not in the mood today, so I'm going to kind of dial it in. I've seen actors do it. And that to me is when the discipline has failed. So to answer your question, the discipline is what enables us to go in and do it in a way that, as we mentioned earlier, the audience don't see the difference, even though you may feel very different that night. Do the job. Go back to the basics. Like, I often find myself picturing myself in the rehearsal room again and just reminding myself that all this is we were just people walking around in a room with tape on the floor. And now, of course, you're here and the audience is there and the lights are on. And it feels like a very different experience, but it's not. You're just doing what you solidified in that rehearsal experience. Just do that. Just go back to those basics. The performance is going to be okay for tonight. I find that kind of works.
The next upcoming project we've got is Swinging Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So tell us about the show. What is it?
Okay. So it's an 18-piece big band. I mean, you know, this swing Rat Pack Vegas stuff, we saw Robbie Williams do it at the Albert Hall many, many years ago. When it's done right, it's incredible stuff. But the problem is in this day and age of backtracks and whatever, even though they're great backtracks, a lot of And with Michael Bublé coming on the scene, I mean, he just transformed everything and made it so much more accessible to people. Everyone started listening to good old Rat Pack, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra songs. Thanks to Robbie, thanks to Michael Bublé. Amy Winehouse has done stuff. And so Adam is so clever. Adam Howard, who's putting this together, he's a true musician. He's a fantastic trumpet player, a fantastic musical director. He's got this incredible big band. They play it right. They feel this stuff. This is their home, and so he thought, we got to do this. He wanted to do. I've dreamt of this, doing a proper swing, cool big band Las Vegas type show. But you got to have if you've got the right musos behind you, it elevates the experience for performer and audience member. Yeah. Tenfold. And so that's what we've got. And it's just going to be glitzy, glamorous, cool. It's going to be funny. It's going to be, I think it's a perfect winter antidote. It's going to be in winter, and we're going to be there on the Teatro stage. It's a dream come true for me, and I hope it is for a lot of the audience members. I think
so. It's yourself and?
Myself, Harry Sideropoulos, Corlia. Hmm? No, I always say her name wrong. It's Corlia. You must put the emphasis on the Corlia.
Okay.
I've done a lot of corporate gigs with her. She's one of the most phenomenal female singers in this country. Timothy Malloy, the man with a velvet voice and a beautiful smile. He just oozes warmth and love. He's fantastic. He's got like a Luther Vandross kind of feel.
Yeah.
Harry, Tim Malloy, Corlia, myself. That's us.
I'm
thinking, is there another one? But it's because Adam's always there with his trumpet. Because, of course, he is a solo feature in it as well.
Okay.
He's conducting and the big band and playing, but he has beautiful solo moments. He's an entertainer and a fantastic trumpeter.
How is doing a show like this different to doing something like We Will Rock You or Buddy Holly? First of all, the rehearsal isn't much less, and let's just understand that.
Yes. The rehearsal is less because you're doing a concert. There's no narrative here. So we're not portraying characters, although we may sort of take on the energy and persona perhaps as a reference. You know, if, for instance, if Tim Malloy is singing Frank Sinatra, he might, you know, take on a little bit more of that cool, as opposed to Harry Sideropoulos coming on and doing I don't know if I should say it. It's one of his funny sex bomb or something like that. Where we know he's going to turn on the craziness and the charisma. Yeah. So you kind of inhabit the style of the song, and these songs are very, very animated. There is a character behind them, but we're not going to be in a rehearsal room discussing the character in depth. We're putting on a concert. So what's important is just get the stylistic elements of the song and the era and the period right, and deliver that in an entertaining way for the audience. So it's a different journey. This is more of a concert, because it's so vast, because Adam Howard has decided to look at the Vegas of old and the Vegas of new.
Yeah.
It's quite great because you're going all the way from Frank Sinatra, Rat Pack stuff, to Tom Jones, to Amy Winehouse, to Robbie Williams, to Michael Bublé.
Yes,
you know, who've all been at Vegas. They've all been performing in Vegas now.
As we were setting up for this interview, you mentioned something, and it triggered a spark of a question for me, so I'm bringing it up now. You said something to the effect of, oh, you hope the tickets sell well. So whatever type of show or production you're in, whether it's this or Buddy Holly, is that a worry for the actors about how many people in the seats? And when there are less people in the seats, obviously, you intend to put the same energy in there, but
sure.
Does that affect you guys?
Look, I mean, it can be very disheartening to walk out to do your job, and the lights will flash around the auditorium, and you go, oh, we got a very small house.
Yes,
discipline again, do the job. You never know who's out there. It's this is very, very true. I mean, I did a matinee once in the, I think I was in Cornwall in the UK, 2 o'clock matinee of Greece. And I've never dialed it in. I always try. And on that afternoon, I walked out and these two ladies came up to me and said, we have been saving up for so long to come and watch this show. It's our favorite show. Our husbands, who are now passed, we saw it with them. It brings back memory. And you just don't know what your performance, you wake up, you're feeling grim, it's a early Saturday matinee. Oh, I'll save it for the evening show. You can't think like that. You can't do that. So yeah, it's easier said than done again. I mean, you walk out and if you have a full house, I always remind myself to be grateful for that. I've been very lucky for instance shows like Chicago, Rocky Horror, that I've done, Sound of Music, We Will Rock You. These shows sold out. These shows, South African audiences came, they loved them, and when South African audiences are on your side, they support like no one else. So I've been very lucky with that. I also remember going back now to the Buddy Holly story when we first did it, which became a phenomenon in this country. But on the 12th of December, my birthday, 3 days after yours.
Yes.
My birthday on the 12th of December, 1993, we were at the Joburg Theatre, and it was then called the Civic Theatre, and we had one row of people. I remember there was one row.
Yeah.
And it became a row because we said to them, come, just sit in one.
Yeah, yeah.
And we played to a row of people in this 1,200-seater. And I remember, maybe because I was young and I was thinking less or whatever, I just did it. I was like, no, you deserve it as much as anyone else. And we did it. And by the end of that run, a few months later, we, for the first time in South Africa, had ticket touts selling tickets in front of the – so it became a sellout. So you never know. Sometimes it's a process. With Swing in Las Vegas, we don't have that kind of time. We don't have an existing piece that people can reference. You know, if people say, oh, Sound of Music, oh, great.
Yeah.
So we must book for that because we grew up on this.
Yeah.
We Will Rock You. Oh, Queen fans will come, you know. Here, we kind of going, look, okay, it's Rat Pack, it's Swing, it's Vegas. That obviously appeals to a lot of people. It's winter in Johannesburg. Will they come? I believe it's a perfect antidote for that. So
yes.
Hopefully they will. Yeah. And so there is that concern. There's always that concern.
So I remember years ago, Jason Donovan was here performing in the Fantastics.
Yes.
I remember when I went to go see it, and I think there were about five of us in the theater. And I felt for me, I feel it, like, feel so bad for the person. Like, I can't remember if I enjoyed the show, but I'm like, I'm being here for him. And it was...
You, as an audience member, you're almost taking the responsibility onto, hey, we are loving it. Yeah, you kind of feel responsible.
Anyway, so Swing in Las Vegas, looking forward to that. Any little sneak peeks or treats you can surprise us with?
What Adam has done so brilliantly is he's given us the songs that... that cater to our strengths.
Okay.
So like I said, Harry has got that rough. He's so easy. He's such an entertainer, and he's going to be bringing the humor. There's going to be a lot of comedy and Harry sexing it up, so to speak. Yeah. Which is always very entertaining and very funny and he's very good at it.
Yeah.
Timothy Malloy is going to be treating everyone to the velvety, beautiful crooning numbers that'll hit you right in the heart. Cordelia is going to be blowing your hair back. I mean, she's going to hit the back wall like you can't believe. And I'm there. I think Adam is using me as a little bit of a kind of the showman stuff. Maybe we'll be looking at a little bit of the Elvis Las Vegas, a little bit of Elvis there, which kind of is my bag, so to speak. So there's going to be a little bit of something for everyone. It's going to be entertaining. It's going to have a lot of energy, a lot of vibe. It's not going to be a laid back. Lounge singing affair. It's not that. We're going to hit hard, and when this brass section blows, and when Rob is on the drums doing what he does, it's going to be powerful and entertaining from the moment that curtain goes up. It's going to be from that overture. The big band does an overture. It's fantastic.
Okay, so last question.
Mm.
Three shows on stage that you've yet to perform in on your bucket list that you'd still like to do so.
Okay. I've always wanted to play Joe Gillis in Sunset Boulevard. I think I'm too old now, but it has been a dream of mine for a long time. And I was cast to do it in London, and then it came off. It actually ended.
Okay.
A dream role of mine. Frankenfurter was one which I did.
Yes.
And which I would do at the drop of a hat again. I've always wanted to play Javert Les Mis. I don't know if vocally I am equipped for that, especially anymore. But there was a time that was a massive dream of mine. I think with Les Mis, you kind of go through the phase. I wanted to be Andre Ross, then I wanted to be Marius. And you think, okay, I'm getting too old. I want to be Javert. I would be honored to be in that production. I just think it's superb. And what else? I wouldn't mind a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde, actually. I would love to do that as well. Great acting acting role with singing. You know, sometimes it's more singing driven and the acting is, well, you know, it's secondary. Yeah. But I'm more of an actor than a singer.
Okay.
So, yeah, for me, that would be a dream come true.
Okay, so the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
Be open to change. Don't take yourself too seriously, because none of us are going to make it out alive. Enjoy this while you can. Gratitude. Be happy. Be grateful. Be mindful and enjoy the ride.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook @CelebSavant. That's CelebSavant.